Tom Woods Show, episode 889.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, the Tom Woods Show.
Hey, all you shavers out there, Harry's wants to send you a free trial set. Razor handle, 5-blade cartridge, and shaving gel. Best shave you ever had, just pay for shipping. Check it out at harrys.com/woods. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Always fun talking to Paul Gottfried, who is formerly professor of humanities at Elizabethtown College. He's the author of many books. I've profited from every Paul Gottfried book I've read. And in particular, I want to talk today about Revisions and Dissents, which is a series of essays on various historical topics and with a bit of current events thrown in at the very end, we'll say, but an outstanding book. Paul holds a PhD in history from Yale. We'll try not to hold that against him. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me again.
All right, so the book is Revisions and Dissents. I want you, even though it's a variety of topics that's covered, tell me if there's a thread running through these revisions and dissents.
Yes, indeed there is a thread, and it is this, that most of the people who are featured as important historians by the American Historical Association, the Association of Modern Historians, whatever they're called, the ones who are written up in New York Review of Books, the New York Times, etc., National Review, New Republic, etc., hold very conventional historical views, which seem to be generally shaped by some kind of ideological consensus. And I was struck by this many years ago, actually more than 50 years ago when I was a graduate student at Yale, that certain points of view you were not even allowed to express. For example, criticism of Woodrow Wilson and American involvement in World War I, or the uniformly negative view of the German, the German Second Empire, and the achievement of Bismarck, the views we were allowed to express were the ones that the professor held, and he would. I remember particularly professors in German history would talk about how authoritarian German universities were, and what struck me is I could not imagine a more authoritarian setting than the one that I was in there. So what I do in this book is simply revisit certain historical topics which I think have been treated in a establishmentarian and ideological fashion, and try to present alternative points of view which make at least as much sense to me as the views that were forced down my throat as a graduate student in which I read in prestigious highbrow American magazines.
All right, well, in light of that introduction to the book, then, that means I want to skip ahead to chapter 4, and then we'll get to some of the other things later. But the problem of historical connections in here. Now, this is a great example of historians who have an ideological axe to grind, who wind up weaving these tales that are coming in large part out of their own imaginations. Mm-hmm. And that we see beginning in the way late 19th century, well, the way Germany is covered, period. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious about, let's start there, the way Germany, not just in World War II, but also in World War I, I mean, that's really, you know, okay, I mean, I get that Hitler's a bad guy, but World War I, the situation is obviously a bit more subtle than that.
Right.
And even before that. So let's start with Bismarck. Are they getting Bismarck right?
No. The view of Bismarck is generally that he was a precursor of Adolf Hitler. The Jonathan Steinberg sort of official American biography, presents that view or depicts him as somebody who looks toward Kaiser Wilhelm, who looks toward Hitler, initiates what they call the German Sonderweg, you know, the peculiar path of Germans to modernity, which results in Hitler. And Bismarck is, a stellar figure in this demonology. What I try to do is present what seems to me a more balanced picture of him. By the way, you know, it's sort of reached a point that now that the Germans are faced with the anniversary of the 500th anniversary of Luther's Reformation, they don't know what the hell to do with it, because Luther has now been reinterpreted as a Nazi or precursor of the Nazis who made anti-Semitic remarks while at dinner. And most people in the Lutheran Church in Germany aren't Christians anymore. So what they're doing is they're simply discussing all the bad things that Luther said and how he was an anti-Semite, a racist, and a sexist. It's as if they can't even handle things that happened hundreds of years ago. As a friend of mine, Robbie Stove, points, I think I quote this, that if an American neoconservative or liberal listens to Bach's St. Matthew Passion there, they claim to be able to discern the blueprint for Auschwitz or something like that. But, I mean, it's reached a point of absolute hysteria. I mean, it's not become any better. And the attempt to look for precursors of Hitler everywhere, not only in Bismarck, but in people who lived 1,000 years ago, you know, seems to go on and on.
Well, let me say, can I just say a word about Luther, because I've actually read a lot of the things that he's said about the Jews, and they are quite blood-curdling. I mean, these Jewish folks, you got to keep an eye on them. I mean, well, you know, some people have said things like that, and they shouldn't say that, but,
right.
This is pretty bad stuff, but that does not mean that, therefore, he would, you know, wink at, you know, at executing Jews. So
that's correct.
So,
yeah.
But my point is, I don't want to breeze through this as if we're just talking about a few jokes he told on the side. These are horrifying things.
He said
things about the Pope that are far worse, but that's another matter.
Right. You're right. He was a very splenetic Christian. He made very strong comments about people and things he disagreed with. But I mean, obviously, this is not the whole of, you know, the story. You do not encapsulate the Reformation by quoting remarks that he made about the Pope or the Jews. But I think that the Germans have sort of reached a point in this reductionism of everything to Hitler that, you know, they even great people in their past like Kant or Hegel or Luther, whoever, they're always looking for things that they said that were politically incorrect. This has reached a point at which, you know, Germans publish dissertations and books on Kant, you know, as a racist, because he assumed some kind of racial inequality in his writings in anthropology in the 18th century, as did everybody else, of course. But, you know, they go after him, or that Hegel, in his philosophy of history, assigned a lower place in the moral spiritual order to the Jews than the Christians, shows he was an anti-Semite, which clearly he was not. But this goes on and on. I mean, this game of blaming your ancestors for not being politically correct and trying to attach to them the stigma of being a precursor of the Nazis.
Well, what is the correct way, then, to think about a historical figure like Bismarck?
You know, A, that he's a man of his age. B, that he's a great statesman. C, that he does unify the German nation. And as I point out, he is certainly not solely responsible for the wars through which German unification is achieved. One of the things I look at is, you know, the question of why is Bismarck, who achieves unification of his country, one might say with relatively little bloodshed, why is he worse than Abraham Lincoln, whose war resulted in the death of over 700,000 Americans and left large sections of the United States devastated? You know, why is Lincoln a greater moral figure than Bismarck? This is something I keep coming back to. And by the way, I'm not a Lincoln hater, but the point is, if we're going to condemn everybody in the past who engaged in civil war, who fought wage wars and so forth as, you know, as proto-Nazis, I suppose one could make the same judgment about Lincoln, certainly Woodrow Wilson, who was a racist and got us into World War I. But certain people seem to be exempt from the criticisms that are laid against Bismarck and other figures in German history.
Well, let's fast forward to World War I. I had Hunt Thule on last week, and we did talk about the Fisher thesis a little bit. I've probably talked about that with you a long time ago, but not everybody has listened to all 889 episodes of The Tom Woods Show. You may find that hard to believe. So I think it's worth talking about now. Do you think because there obviously is a kind of Germanophobic aspect to well, Western culture these days, and, mm-hmm. and has been for a long time, even in Germany itself to some degree. And
particularly in Germany itself.
Right. And no doubt among the historical profession. Do you think of the Fisher thesis, which I'd first of all like you to explain, as being a subset of that, or is Fisher just a dispassionate scholar who came to a view that was different from yours?
He is certainly not a dispassionate scholar. He was a fairly high-placed Nazi academic official who ratted on his colleagues to the Nazi Party during World War II. They were going to put him up for trial as a war criminal, but then he underwent some kind of conversion to anti-German or Germanophobia. And this is clearly reflected in his book, Germany's Das war Deutschlands Griff nach der Weltmacht, Germany's Bid for World Empire. What he does is give you sort of a version of Germany's march toward the First World War, which totally ignores all of the countervailing evidence that this is not true. And there's mountains of evidence that he ignores that, A, Germany did not plan, you know, a general European war to create a large empire in Central Europe. B, there were other players who were responsible for the war. And C, the war aims expressed by the German Chancellor, Theobald von Bethmann-Hollweg, in September 1914, were created after the war had begun and were no more outlandish than the war aims that came from England, France, Russia, and other powers. Indeed, England, from the moment it gets into the war, and France from the time it gets into the war, are committed to the utter destruction of Germany. Totally, rip the whole thing apart, reduce it to principalities that could be controlled by foreign countries, and have the French take over Western Germany and the Russians Eastern Germany. So this goes well beyond what the Germans are calling for. But what Fisher is doing is obviously playing to German war guilt over Hitler and trying to extend the condemnation, you know, of Hitler's war of conquest and the dominance of Nazi ideology in the Second World War back to the First World War and to the German Second Empire. As far as I can see, the Fisher thesis should have absolutely no standing as a serious historical argument. It was, however, the only view of the First World War that we were allowed to have when I was a graduate student, which is one of the reasons I decided I wasn't going to write on the subject, because I would have been probably kicked out of graduate school. Certainly my dissertation would have been rejected. But the Fisher thesis still seems to have proponents or supporters in certain camps. A, in Germany, it is the only government official interpretation of the war, although there's lots of fine German scholarship that has come out even in the last few years, which clearly refutes, takes apart everything in the Fisher thesis, you know, for the 500th or 1,000th time. But, you know, another group that is constantly pushing the Fisher thesis is the neoconservatives. And there the reason is quite clear. They're angry at Auschwitz. They're angry at the Nazis. They hate the Germans and are trying to push back the Nazi phenomenon into an earlier period, to Bismarck, maybe earlier in time. There was a piece in the Weekly Standard, by the way, I think the latest issue of the Weekly Standard, so David Gordon tells me, that insists that the United States should have entered World War I in 1914 to deal with the German, militaristic threat, although the United States was in no way threatened by Germany.
Right. But, is this Arthur Herman who wrote that?
No, Arthur Herman wrote another piece. His was a National Review, but he has the same view, by the way. He's a Fisherite.
Okay, then that's what I was thinking of. Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So we should have gotten involved earlier. And by the way, go ahead. But then I want to ask you about something John McCain said. That I'm sure you could be waiting with bated breath for that.
A great hero of mine. Yeah, right. No, the other group that seemed to like the Fisher thesis are Thatcherite British historians like Max Hastings, whom I've written a review, and they don't seem to be influenced by anything else. I mean, they deny the evidence of British complicity, or at least complicity of the Edward Grey's government of Churchill in the machinations that lead to the war, making promises, dangerous promises to the French and Russians in 1914 and even earlier. You know, Hastings, other British historians seem to, and I think Paul Johnson, go on pushing the Fisher thesis. Well, ask me your other question. I'm still answering that one at length.
Well, it actually moves forward to World War II just for a second, only because I was reminded of it by this idea that we should have gotten into World War I earlier.
Right.
I'm pretty sure John McCain, at one time or another, has said that if the U.S. had intervened at the moment of the remilitarization of the Rhineland, mm-hmm. then that would have been the time to do it, and we should have gotten in at that point. Now, that's pretty early on in the history of Hitler's moves in the 30s. How do you react to that?
I entirely agree, believe it or not. No, I think in 1936, Hitler would have been overthrown by the German military and people in the diplomatic corps. And he, you know, he basically calls the bluff of the other side. And it might have been quite possible to get rid of him in 1936, even as late as 1938. And finally, it would have been possible to get rid of the Nazi regime, you know, in 1944, if the United States had cooperated with the German resistance instead of actually turning them in to the Nazis, which was done by Alan Dulles at the time. But there were various points at which the United States, you know, short of bombing half of Europe, you know, could have stopped the Nazis.
All right. Well, I was not expecting you to say that. I would be interested to hear Pat Buchanan's response. You actually wrote an interesting review of Pat's book on World War II, but I don't want to get too far afield. I want to stick to the, I mean, you're here to talk about this book, and I think one of my pet peeves is you go on to talk about your book, and the host talks about everything in the world other than your book. We're not doing that.
Right.
Talk about that some other time. There's a essay in here, Defining Right and Left, mm-hmm. which is a real passion of mine, especially because I run into a lot of people who are otherwise wonderful, lovely people who say there's no such thing as right and left. And I think
right.
they're just so jaded by the Ron Paul experience. They feel like right and left is all just a sham.
Right.
It's just,
mm-hmm.
you know, the state is just monolithic. And to some degree, I mean, it is interesting to watch how respectable right and left close ranks against outsiders, whether it's Buchanan or Jerry Brown.
Mm-hmm.
I get that. I think that's quite interesting. But on the other hand, I think it's going much too far to say there's no such thing as right and left. There absolutely is. History makes no sense unless there's a right and a left.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious to know what you think. Not, I have no interest in what Jonah Goldberg thinks right and left are, but what do you think are the really defining beliefs that make the right what it is and make the left what it is?
Yeah, if you notice, I distinguish between conservatism and the right. The argument that I make is that the left has pretty much won within conventional politics and establishment journalism. And the left believes in universalism, equality, human rights, the interchangeability of everybody, men, women, whatever, that, you know, everybody is the same, or everybody can be reconstructed to be the same by a benevolent state. What characterizes the right is that it opposes the left's projects. There's classical conservatism, which I argue, one might say with increasing futility, is dead. You know, I mean, it's to someone like Richard Weaver, Russell Kirk, Joseph de Maistre, Edmund Burke expressed classical conservative positions. But they were never particularly strong in the United States. And if we have any kind of conservative tradition, it's probably some kind of fusion of Calvinism and classical liberalism. But we really don't have anything like a European classical conservative tradition. We do have a right. And the right opposes the left's project for a number of reasons, one of which is that it does not believe in the efforts of the state to achieve equality. Thinks that this is a tyrannical effort. The right also believes that people are communal. They're organic. They have organic relations to other people, and that the managerial state is a threat to traditional social organic relations. And then finally, the right believes in particularity. You know, it wishes to defend communities, nations where they exist. It rejects the idea of the universal state, to quote Leo Strauss. This is one of the few times he was right. So in all these respects, we have the right. You know, I've been encountering the same argument that you've been complaining against among French conservative Frenchmen or nationalists who keep telling me that they're no longer right and left in France. It's just the working class and the internationalist elite or something like that. Well, the working class in France is on the right because it opposes the universal state. It is fighting for traditional community. You and I may not like its economic programs, but, you know, what drives it is, you know, is a rightist impulse. So I would agree with you. I think right and left are very much alive. I mean, the terms are very relevant, even if most of the political establishment throughout the Western world, including the neoconservatives, particularly the neoconservatives, belong to the left.
I know some people may think this is just nitpicking to be concerned about labels like this, but I don't think it is. I think this really gets to the heart of what differentiates people. So I want to pick up on this in just a minute after we thank our sponsor. Folks, if you're a regular listener of this show, you know what I got one of my favorite guests, Michael Malice, for a gift when I was floundering around thinking what I could get for him. I got him a great shave set from Harry's because I've had such great experiences with it. I thought, why should I have all the fun of an awesome shave and looking great and feeling great? Let's let Michael Malice have some happiness in his life. So I gave him that gift, and Harry's wants to give you a gift. They want to give you their trial set for free for just 3 smackers to cover the shipping. It's a 13-smacker value. It's the razor handle, 5 precision-engineered blades with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, a rich lathering shave gel, and a travel blade cover for nothing. Just 3 smackers for shipping. You get this beautiful set. And if you don't think this is the most awesome shave you ever had, well, I owe you a Coke. Check it out at harrys.com/woods. That's a $13 value for free. Just cover shipping at harrys.com/woods. All right, I have to bring this up because it's a libertarian show with a libertarian audience.
Right.
With some conservatives thrown in. And in there, you make the claim that I totally get that libertarianism is a product of the left. And I suppose in the broad historical sweep of things, there's probably no denying that. I mean, if they're against an established religion, well, that's not rightist. They, by and large, were against the monarchies of their day. Well, there's nothing rightist about that. Mm-hmm. They wanted freedom of speech and freedom of thought. I mean, that is radical. I'll give you that. Okay.
Yes.
But at the same time, I think you hit on something that could, at least in today's context, clearly place libertarianism, at least some brands of it, in the rightist camp, which would be, I believe in organic communities, I believe in particularity, I believe in tradition, and it's precisely because I believe that the state as it exists now and it is as it is ever likely to exist as long as you or I live or can conceive of is always and everywhere going to be an enemy of that, that I'm anti-statist. Not, you know, not because I necessarily at, you know, at 2 a.m. want to, you know, make bird noises on my roof standing on one leg. It's because of these rooted and these traditional reasons that I'm against the state. So do I qualify?
Absolutely you do. As a matter of fact, you have restated my argument with greater eloquence and precision than I do in my book. Or my book on fascism, in which I end up putting Ron Paul and, I don't know, the Falange in the same, or say that, you know, objectively they're both on the right because they oppose the left. And, you know, I'm always using that classical Marxist term that objectively here's where you stand. You know, no matter what you say, that, you know, I remember the late Ralph Rako. He liked Frédéric Bastiat and would always, you know, who was a radical leftist in his time. But most of the things Ralph said to me sounded very, very right wing. The same with Murray Rothbard. So, you know, I think that many libertarians, particularly what we call paleo-libertarians, are driven to libertarian positions partly by their reactionary social views. Or at least their reactionary social views are compatible with their libertarian.
Yeah, right,
ideas.
Right, right. I can definitely see that. I want to move on to your chapter. And I'm going to let you describe this. You have a chapter called "Liberal Democracy as a God Term."
Right.
I'm just going to let you talk about that.
you're letting me grind my axe again.
Is here for, Paul.
Right. You know, I had a conversation with David Gordon about this yesterday, and he liked the essay on liberal democracy, and I told him I did not make up the statement at the beginning of that essay that when a Straussian superior of mine at Rockford College about 45 years ago said that we have to oppose the Soviets because we are defending liberal democracy. I thought he meant something like George McGovern or Hubert Humphrey. I never had heard that term before. Now liberal democracy is like the official credo of the official conservative movement. And as far as I can tell, it means something like an American welfare state that engages in moderate social engineering and unleashes wars for human rights or something like that, and which has periodic elections to endorse what the governing class do, right? I think that's what liberal democracy probably means. Because it is not democracy in the sense that I can understand it, nor is it liberalism, which if you read my book, After Liberalism, I land up defining as something like 19th century bourgeois liberalism. It's neither. It is not even a melange. I think it's an entirely new creation, and I think it is a justification for a particular regime, which is the United States as it has evolved since the New Deal, or particularly since the 1960s, and is usually tied to the project of bringing a government similar to ours, if not entirely identical, to benighted people everywhere in the world. As you know, the neoconservatives John McCain and Lindsey Graham would call for doing. So what also strikes me is the word liberal democracy hardly ever appears in American historical political discussions beyond post World War II period. I think it first gets used during the Second World War in the struggle against fascism. And then, sort of picked up by Hubert Humphrey, Cold War liberals, and then recycled again by the neoconservatives.
And now, this is one of these terms, though, that's easy for somebody like Paul Gottfried to say liberal democracy. What a crummy idea. But then somebody might legitimately want to say, well, Paul Gottfried, if you had your druthers, what would replace it?
At this point in time, it's very, it's hard to do anything other than agree with Ron Paul and Tom Woods and say, we really have to cut back the scale of government, get rid of the deep state, and stop using these stupid ideological labels for everything. The United States was created as a constitutional republic. I sort of like to get back to that idea as much as we can in the United States, have a modest foreign policy, one that does not aim at engaging in crusades, democratic crusades, in other societies that have no interest in adopting the present American form of government.
Okay.
So, I sort of want to push back against what we have. I really cannot say, my ideal might be the early American Republic, but we're not going to go back to that at this point.
No, that's right.
Too many things have changed.
That's right. I remember Rothbard willing to compromise and saying, I will go back to the federal budget under George Washington, all right? Just
that's
to show
pretty,
I'm not
good.
An extremist, right?
Pretty good.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, there's a lot of European history that's covered in here, of course, because mm-hmm. that's really where you've done a lot of your work. And I wonder, as I'm looking it over, because I actually read this quite some time, not a year, but many months ago, let's say, read the original manuscript. And I actually recommended at the time that there be a Trump chapter added because it seemed so relevant.
Oh, you were the one. Who
yeah, I'm
you
sorry.
Write that.
Yeah, now it comes out that I was the anonymous guy who recommended
right.
that. So we'll have to say something about that in just a minute. But give me one of these. You probably don't remember the chapter names offhand, but give me a European, like a modern European topic that we need to hit where everybody's all wrong. I guess that would be pretty much anything. But
well, there was one. It was one review I wrote of the this book by Kurtzer on Pius the 11th and Mussolini. And
oh,
I have
right.
to say,
yes.
I was never outraged by any stupid book as much as I was by that. And he won prizes. And the Italian Senate had to listen to this junk, which he probably delivered in Brooklynese English or something. But it's a horrible book. And, I was just like sitting there reading this thing. And, it was like every leftist cliche, misplaced accusations of anti-Semitism. And then the New York Review of Books, devoted, an issue or half an issue to this work. I enjoyed writing that review and just taking the book apart.
All right. Well, that is actually a very satisfying chapter in here. I will concede. let's say something about the, were you, by the way, were you really not going to put a Trump chapter in there?
I was not, because I thought it was a little bit too contemporary. But then when my, the acquisition editor, Amy Ferranto, pushed me a bit, you know, I finally did it. And she, I'd written these essays on Trump for, I think, Front Page or so, maybe Rockwell. And she wanted me to write one. She said, and one of the readers insisted that you that you had this.
Right.
So I just went ahead and did it.
So, yeah. So, I mean, of course, it's not customary to admit that I was a reader for this, but I'm doing it anyway.
It's okay.
And I because I thought that the book was going so for the jugular with stuff like the end of history, and now that we have liberal democracy and open borders and all,
right,
you know,
right.
And that this is the norm and everybody's happy about it, and globalism and interconnectedness, when clearly there's this mass movement around the world of people who rightly or wrongly are not in favor of it and
do not
believe that history is all over, then therefore Trump has to be commented on as somebody who is in some way contradicting this. But yet Trump, as I have said till I'm blue in the face, is such a frustratingly unsystematic thinker. It's like he doesn't even see, it's almost like he's not reading your books, Paul, but it's like he doesn't see where he stands in all this. I think he thinks he's a guy who wants to fix the trade issue and try and build a wall. And you know, that's, it's not like he doesn't even get what his historical significance would be if he were aware of it.
I think you're right. And if, you know, he seems to be drifting into the neoconservative camp with Kushner, and, you know, trying to bring on board people like Lindsey Graham and Syria and so forth. I don't think he even understands his own base very well, or at least not the intellectual wing of his base, which, you know, seems to be coming out of the old right or paleo-libertarians or some camp he does not understand at all. But you're right, I think he has a very limited agenda, and I think much of his worldview was shaped by the society in which he has lived in the last 70 years. And I doubt it was our society, you know, in which he lived. So, you know, it doesn't surprise me that people say he's sort of like, you know, moving back in the direction of the neoconservatives. Since I don't think, I agree with you, I don't think he has very firm ideas or any kind of firm ideological commitment other than building a wall and dealing with trade issues and possibly rebuilding the American military.
But when he was friendly with Farage over in Britain, I thought, okay, maybe he sees a connection between himself and those people, and the fact that he cheered on Brexit, I thought meant, okay, maybe he kind of does get who he is.
Right.
And
mm-hmm.
and I'm glad I just got done saying, I've said this now several times on the show, but one thing that makes me happy is that although there are some people who will follow him no matter what he does, and there are people who will follow him only when he does stupid things, he has supporters who are willing to come out and say, you know, I'm really, really concerned about the direction he's moving
in. Yes, he does.
I didn't see that from, I mean, yeah, I know there are leftists like at Counterpunch who didn't like Obama that much.
Right.
But I'm talking about the general run of his supporters. I mean, my Facebook feed, I have some people on my Facebook feed who supported Trump, and it is flooded with people saying this is an outrage that he wants to intervene in the Middle East even more than we thought he might. And whereas I did not see that under Obama. They just ignored his foreign policy, or they made excuses for it. So that I think goes to show that our side, such as it is better than their side. I'm just going to come right out and say it. Our side's better.
No, I agree. I agree. Or at least those in our side who think. I think there's a great unwashed.
That's vanishingly small number, unfortunately.
Right. The great unwashed who supported Trump, like no matter what he did. You know, where I live, we have, you know, lots of deplorables, and real deplorables, not like us. We're just symbolic deplorables.
Right.
But the real deplorables, you know, like anything he does, you know, he bombed the hell out of those people and said, it's fine, you know.
Yeah.
If he decides he doesn't want to do it, that's okay, too. So, I think he does have maybe 30 to 35% core support, which will go with him anywhere that he goes. They just like him. They like his style.
And see, that goes to show what a missed opportunity he is, because he has this unprecedented connection with people.
Mm-hmm.
He could stand up to them and say, you know, we've all been had by these people. Man, did they get us into a quagmire. Why don't we rebuild our own country? They'd cheer for that.
Yeah. The thing that I am concerned about, it almost seems as if he did what he did with the Tomahawk missiles because he is trying to improve his popularity in the United States and trying to neutralize opposition. which is relentless, which was relentless until he unleashed those tomahawks. Now, he, you know, people say nice things about him on CNN.
Yeah.
And Bill Kristol said, you know, at last he's my president. And I heard Jamie Kirchick.
Oh, no, don't tell me. No, if anything, he's worse.
He was praising Trump, but also pointing out Trump should also now send, like, you know, umpteen thousand people into the Middle East to fight, you know, to fight against against Assad. You know, but this is, unfortunately, this is only the first step. Now they want more.
They're not going to be satisfied until
there's half the American population.
Yeah, and until an Islamic government is installed in Syria, then they'll scratch their heads and pretend they had no idea this was going to happen, and then it'll start all over again.
Yeah.
All right. Look.
Well, wait.
No. Go ahead.
No, I was just pointing out that Trump may even be prevented by the media and even by people like Tillerson and Nikki Haley, who scares me, from making any kind of deal with Putin. I mean, the Russians do have vital interest in Syria. They've ports there. They're not going to give them up. If you want to get rid of Assad, you're going to have to work out some kind of agreement with the Russians. But the neoconservatives and the warmongers who are rallying to Trump don't want that. They want a confrontation with Russia as well. In fact, they see the Syrian engagement, you know, as the first step to having a more serious confrontation with Russia.
Yeah, yeah. This is why the whole thing, the left had nothing to worry about, it turns out. They were so terrified at the prospect of peace with Russia.
Right.
Don't worry, people. No worries about that. You got your wish on that. And it goes to show, I coined a new law, Woods' Law. This is my fourth. I come up with them once in a while. And Woods' Law is, no matter whom you vote for, you always wind up with John McCain. And I mean,
it doesn't thought.
Exactly. I mean, it doesn't precisely sum up America, but it's close.
Yes,
it's close. All right, the book is Revisions and Dissents. They're tremendous essays by Paul Gottfried. You will learn an enormous amount. I'm linking to it on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/889. And Paul, this was great fun. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me again.
Okay, I have two things I have to tell you. Number one, there won't be any episodes tomorrow, that is Thursday or Friday of this week, leading into Easter, so we will be raring to go starting next week. We will be doing an episode of Contra Krugman, as usual, this week, and that's going to be an interesting one because it does deal with the Syria issue. We're going to bring on a special guest, not Scott Horton this time because I just talked to Scott on this show, but a guest who's never been on Contra Krugman before. So if you're not listening to my sister podcast, which I produce with Bob Murphy once a week, called Contra Krugman, you can find that at ContraKrugman.com. Second thing is, wow, is this a great website from a listener of the show. It's called The Nomadic Professor, and you'll find it at NomadicProfessor.com. No the in the URL. It's just NomadicProfessor.com. And he says to me, in a nutshell, I'm a history professor who now teaches completely online, giving me the mobility required to create on-location mini-lectures around the world. Right now, my wife, four kids, and I are on a 2-year shoestring budget world trip, creating nomadic professor content all along the way. We'll hit 6 continents in the process, maybe all 7. Eventually, I'll roll out full history courses, too, supplemented by on-location lectures. From time to time, my libertarianism bleeds through my videos, but I try to keep it subtle. Clearly, I'm no professional, but the videos get better and better, so I'm excited about the future. In the meantime, we are true nomads. He says, the best thing people can do for me if they like my stuff, subscribe to my YouTube channel and or become my patron on Patreon. So you'll find links for that at nomadicprofessor.com. Boy, that looks great. That's a brilliant idea. Great. NomadicProfessor.com will be linked at tomwoods.com/889, as the listener website mentioned. And, of course, I'll be linking to Paul Gottfried's book that we talked about today, Revisions and Dissents. All right, that is it. It is radio silence from the Tom Woods Show from now until through the weekend. So I'll see you next week. You can always, do something productive, spiritually or otherwise, over the next few days. I have produced almost 900 episodes. That should always keep a person busy during any Tom Woods downtime. All right. Thanks a lot, everybody. See you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.